Well, we're now in the fourth week of our summer message series that we're calling Good Friends. As we've been saying, good friends are definitely one of life's great blessings. But the premise of this series is that the best friend you could ever have is God. And so over the last few weeks, we've been looking at what it takes to be good friends with God. And so far, we've talked about three qualities that are important for developing and maintaining a friendship with God. The first is what we did right at the beginning of Mass. Do you remember that? We made amends. We made amends to our friend God for the times that we have failed him, for our sins, and for our shortcomings. Every time we do something to damage the friendship, God goes right to work to try to fix the relationship. And we should try to do the same. We shouldn't hold back. We should humbly confess our sins to him because we know that as our friend, he's going to lift us up and bring us back into his embrace of friendship. The second quality is trust. Friendship simply cannot survive without trust. God trusts you with a lot of things. Did you ever think about that? God trusts you with the money that he has given you. God trusts you with the time he has given you. God trusts you with your health and your life, the life that he has given you. He trusts you with the mission and the unique purpose that he has bestowed upon you that only you can carry out for him. God trusts you to do the right thing with all of those resources. And so we also should trust our friend God by handing over every concern to him and believing and trusting that he's going to take care of it. He's going to take care of you according to his inscrutable will. Friends also, you know, they share common interests, and that's the third quality of becoming a good friend with God. God has certain interests, and if you want to be a friend of God, you have to take seriously what he takes seriously. You have to make his interests your interests. You have to adopt his mission as your own. So what is God's interest? Well, his first priority, his greatest interest, what he takes the most seriously is you and people like you. He wants to make new friends. He wants to bring everyone into his friendship. And so to call yourself a friend of God, you have to do something, even if it's a little thing, something to try to win new friends for God. And last week, we said that the easiest way to do that, at least we think, is through a process we call invest and invite. You invest in the people around you, your friends, your neighbors, your classmates, your coworkers, your social acquaintances. How do you invest in them? You get to know them. You learn about them. You take an interest in their life. You listen to their stories. You listen to their troubles. You basically pour into them and love them. That's how you invest. And then when the time is right, when you see the right opening, you invite them here with you to church so that they too can become a friend of God. Well, that's what we talked about the first 3 weeks of the series. Today, we're going to talk about one more important quality aspect of being good friends with God. And to begin, I want you to think about a time, and if it's not too painful, think about a very difficult time in your life in the past. If it's not too painful, call that to mind. Maybe it was a season of difficulty that you went through. Maybe, you know, you lost a loved one, or you lost a job, or one of your kids or grandkids was going through a hard time. Something like that, or a health crisis. And I want you to think about the one person who helped you get through it the most. Chances are that person was a good friend. Even if they were your spouse or relative, they were acting like a good friend. Why? Because good friends lighten the load for each other. You know, good friends share special moments of joy, right? We love going to birthday parties, we love baptisms, we love anniversaries, we love weddings and graduations, all the good times in life, good friends help us celebrate. But friends also, at least the good ones, are with us during times of trouble. When our lives go off the rails, they're there to listen to us, to soothe us, to comfort us. Good friends spend hours in hospital waiting rooms. Good friends spend hours listening with a compassionate ear. Good friends help us get through death, divorce, and other tragedies in life. Good friends just make things easier because they help us carry the load when the burden becomes too great for us to bear alone. And I kind of found that out early on in life in kind of a funny way that I want to share with you. When I was 18, I went to Germany for the summer, and I stayed with a host family who were good friends with my parents. And they had a son named Martin, who was about my same age. Well, it was a great experience. It was an intense and enriching cultural experience in every way, except for one part that I found rather harrowing. A few weeks into the visit, Martin's parents announced that they had signed us up for a week-long camp in a remote part of Sweden, which sounded good. I was very excited, actually, because, as you may know, my mother emigrated to America from Sweden. I grew up in the Swedish culture, and I had been to Sweden many times at that point in my life. So I thought, what could go wrong? Sounded great. So we got on a ferry and we cruised through the Baltic Sea north towards Sweden, and we came to the port at on the southwestern coast of Sweden, a little small town called Varberg. You can see it pictured there. It's very beautiful, isn't it? It's a quaint little town right on the shore. Of course, that's in the summer. You don't want to go there in the winter. Anyway, we got off the ferry, and we had our heavy backpacks, stuffed full of everything that we thought we'd need for a week away in a beautiful Swedish countryside. And then our group leader, there was about 20 of us, he said, go across the street to pick up your bikes for the last leg of the journey. And that's when I got nervous. Bikes? Bikes. See, sadly, I hate to admit this to you, but even though I was only 18, I was totally out of shape. I was not very fit at all, unlike now. And the last time that I had been on a bike, it had training wheels. So I wasn't exactly thrilled about this anyway, but I had no choice, so I got on the bike, and about 10 minutes in, I'm huffing and puffing, and I pull up right next to Martin. I'm like, by the way, Martin, exactly how far away is this camp? He looked over and he said, oh, it's about 65 kilometers from here. Well, I did the math and nearly drove off the road. 40 miles. It was 40 miles to this camp, and I was already worn out. Well, pretty soon, about half an hour later, the road started sloping gently upwards. And about 20 minutes later, we are in an all-out climb into the hills. And let me tell you something, folks. This trip was so physically strenuous, you would not believe it. Take a look at this aerial photo of the area. Okay, I'm kidding, because actually that's only about 600 feet above sea level. But to me, it felt like 6,000 feet, and I was dying. I finally had to just pull off to the side of the road. And the whole group kept going on. I was exhausted and discouraged and embarrassed. Martin happens to look back, and he sees me back there, and he turns around, and he comes up next to me, and he says, what's wrong? And I told him. I admitted it. I said, I don't think I can go on. And without a word and without a blink, he just reached over, and he took my 40-pound backpack off of the luggage rack of my bike and put it on his. And then he said to me, don't worry, I'll carry it for you the rest of the way. Good friends, lighten the load. And that's exactly what Jesus promises in the gospel reading at Mass tonight. He says, come to me, all you who labor and are burdened, and I will give you rest. I will give you rest. And just to make his point even clearer, he uses an image that everyone, pretty much everyone in the crowd that he was speaking to would have understood. Because he says this next. He says, "Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am meek and humble of heart, and you will find rest for yourselves. For my yoke is easy, and my burden is light." What does he mean? Well, you may be thinking of a yoke. Right? You've probably got that mental image, and I'm going to talk about that in a minute. But actually, a yoke in the biblical and Jewish tradition at that time was something, symbolized something very different. A yoke symbolized, wait for it, religious instruction. And some of you kids who have ever been to Faith Formation or taken religious ed classes might feel like it's a yoke, but let me tell you, it was meant to be a good thing. It was a good thing. You see, a yoke symbolized God's law. And God's law was meant to be a gift to the Jewish people because it spelled out exactly how they could live in a fulfilling and loving relationship with God. It was meant to be a yoke that was comforting and comfortable, a form of instruction that was light and easy, a reassuring structure. You know, we all need structure to feel safe. It was a reassuring structure that would lead people, his people, to wisdom and joy and peace. But that's not how it turned out. Because the religious leaders in the time of Jesus interpreted the law so strictly that it became more of a burden. They kept adding things, all kinds of encumbrances. It became more of a burden than a joy, than a pathway to peace and well-being. They added layer upon layer of legal accretions, and it just became so difficult, so nearly impossible for the average person to just obey the law, that the law became what should have been more precious than silver and gold, became a source of guilt and shame and anxiety. What God had intended to be a means to freedom had become a means of oppression in the hands of the religious elite. And you know, there are still people today, actually there's lots of people today, who think that religion is actually a form of bondage, a kind of repressive structure intended to keep people down instead of lead them to freedom and happiness and fulfillment. But Jesus came to deliver his followers, not to enslave them. He wanted to give them rest, not shackle them with more guilt, shame, and anxiety. A few weeks ago, I was at a dinner party with a bunch of people there. And the topic, as always, turned to religion. I don't know, whatever party I go to, the topic is always religion. Do you guys just talk about this all the time when I'm not there? Anyway, surprise, surprise. This one guy turns to me and he says, "Father, do you know where you're going after you die?" I said, "Sure, yeah, I've got a plot down at the Holy Cross Cemetery in Colma. It's already all set up. I did my pre-need, I did everything." He's like, "No, Father, you know what I mean. What's your final destination? Where do you think you're going to end up?" So I gave him my standard line, which I think is funny. I said, "Well, you know, I'm just shooting for purgatory. So I figure if I can get into purgatory, then one day I'm going to get into heaven. It's just a low bar. I just want to get, just slide in, you know, to home base there at purgatory." And he said, he looked at me and he said, "Father, don't you know that Jesus paid the price for you? He did the work. You don't have to worry about getting into purgatory. You should know where you're going. That's the good news, Father." Well, I kind of looked at my shoes rather sheepishly, and I said, "Of course, you're right, of course. But you know, deep down, like a lot of people, in that moment, I just thought, wow, that just seems way too easy." You know, like a lot of people think, and I was thinking, you know, one way or another, I'm going to have to earn God's forgiveness. But it really is not true. That guy was right. It's not true. Jesus suffered the indignity of Roman scourging. He carried the crossbar on his shoulders to the place of crucifixion. He mounted the cross and died so that you and I could be free. Free from what? From sin and death. From sin and death. And that's the greatest kind of freedom you could ever experience, because with that kind of freedom, you never have to worry about death. With that kind of freedom, you don't have to wonder about your eternal destiny. With that kind of freedom, you don't have to question whether your life has meaning and significance, because it does. With that kind of freedom, you never have to live in the regret of your past mistakes. Jesus took on all the consequences of our sin. He accepted all the sin of the world and embraced the worst of humanity so that he could lift the burden of spiritual bondage from our backs. He did do the work. And because of that, we're free. And that's why he said, "Take my yoke upon you." But there is a second meaning to yoke, and that's the one you probably thought of initially. A yoke was placed on oxen and other beasts of burden to help ease the work of hauling a load. It was very common in the agricultural society of Jesus and in Jesus's time. A yoke was a piece of wood that was hand-carved, so it would fit the neck and shoulders of a particular animal to reduce the pain and discomfort. But what you may not know is that yokes in those days very frequently were fitted for a pair of oxen, like you see in that picture there, a pair of oxen working together. The first ox would tend to be an older, more experienced ox. He was trained and hardy from years of hard work. The second would be a younger, newer ox. He had great potential, but he wasn't experienced. And between the two animals, it was the older, experienced ox who would carry the brunt of the load. He would do the majority of the work. That's why Jesus says, "Take my yoke upon you." Because when you do, he will be right there next to you to lift the burdens that you have, to make them lighter, the daily burdens and the struggles that you have in your life. He'll be right there hauling that load with you, right next to you. You may have noticed that the series artwork, you know, that plays right before that fun trailer, before we begin the homily, it's at the end of that trailer. You may have noticed that it has a single set of footprints in the sand. We did that on purpose to remind you of that very famous poem. I hope you've heard of it. It's called Footprints in the Sand. And it's about a man who comes to the end of his life, and he asks God why, at the lowest, hardest, most difficult times in his life, why he only saw one set of footprints in the sand. But all the other times, he saw two sets of footprints, God's and his. And God answered him and said, "My son, in those moments when you only saw one set of footprints, they were mine, because it was then that I was carrying you." Jesus invites everyone who is weighed down with problems in life, everyone who is burdened by disappointment, failure, difficulty, to come to him and find rest. Whatever burden you may be carrying right now, whatever problem in life is pressing on your heart and soul right now, Jesus wants to bear the load with you. He wants to be your oasis, wants to be your escape from the troubles, your respite. Everyone who calls Jesus friend, he becomes a refuge and a relief for, a sanctuary and a safe harbor from life's storms. It's a promise that can never be broken, a promise that can never be walked back, a promise that has no loopholes, a promise that is free of conditions and restrictions. It's a promise of a kind of inner peace that quiets the mind and calms the soul and heals the body no matter what else is going on. It's a kind of peace, a peace that relieves anxiety, reduces stress, and alleviates fear. Your friend God wants to walk with you. He wants to help carry the load with you, alongside you. He'll even carry you when you can't go on alone. And very often, he'll send friends, good friends, into your life to help you get through the crisis and the hurt. And all you have to do is call upon his name, to call him friend, to ask him into your life in an even more deeper way, and he will give you rest. In 1971, Carole King, the great songwriter and singer, Carole King, you kids probably have no idea who I'm talking about, but you will in a minute, she wrote one of the greatest hits of all time. It's called "You've Got a Friend." And we're going to play it now for you. The band's going to sing just a verse or two of it. And as that's happening, I would just invite you to close your eyes and pray quietly to God and just ask him to deepen your friendship. And if there is something on your heart and soul right now that's weighing on you, a difficulty, a burden, ask him to help you carry it. And he will. And he will give you rest.
When you're down in trouble and you need some loving care and nothing is going right, close your eyes and think of me. Soon I will be there to brighten up even your darkest night. You just call out my name and you know wherever I am, I'll come to see you again. Winter, spring, summer, or fall,